how Twitter is changing our politics and our culture. Even if you're not a user of Twitter, it seems impossible to escape it. Tweets by the president can make headlines and move financial markets. Some big movements, such as hashtag Black Lives Matter and hashtag MeToo, have been fueled by Twitter. In the last few years, academics have begun to study the impact of Twitter, and some of their findings are contradictory. Many believe Twitter is an egalitarian virtual public square, giving voice to groups previously ignored by mainstream media. Others point to the rapid dissemination of inaccurate news via Twitter and worry it will destroy our democracy. 280 characters at a time. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with two of the big thinkers who are looking hard at Twitter and its influence on modern culture. What are your thoughts or questions? Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When the Founding Fathers needed to get a message out, they turned to pamphlets. Today, politicians turn to Twitter. But just why has Twitter taken over? And how has it become the source for not only political messaging, but also driving social movements? My two guests today will help us understand how politicians and others use tweets to engage and sometimes enrage their followers, and even those who don't follow or use the social network. Joining me in the studio, Judith Rosenbaum Andre. She is assistant professor in UMaine's Department of Communication and Journalism. She is the author of Constructing Digital Cultures, Tweets, Trends, Race, and Gender. And joining us from a studio in Boston, Brooke Foucault-Wells. She's an assistant professor of communications at Northeastern University who studies social networks shape and constrain human behavior. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you use Twitter? Do you follow people who use Twitter? Are you surprised at how quickly it's become such a prominent source of communication? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm interested in how each of you came to study Twitter in a scholarly way. Judith, what piqued your interest in Twitter?
Well, it was really my students. So before I came to the University of Maine, I worked at Albany State University, a historically black college and university in southwest Georgia. And I would often talk about race in the media, and my students would always bring up what they had said or seen on Twitter. We would, for instance, talk about this really popular show called Empire, and my students would talk about how the previous night them and all of their friends had been on Twitter to debate what characters had said, what they wore, what they thought about it. And the majority of my students at this university were African American, and I got the impression they really saw Twitter as a way to be heard, as a way to counter like dominant views of African Americans in mainstream media, and that really piqued my interest, and I really wanted to find out, you know, how do groups that are generally not heard or seen in mainstream media, how do they use Twitter? Do they use Twitter to, like, counter dominant expressions? You know, were my students' ideas about that correct? And that's really what sparked my interest.
Okay, what about you, Brooke? How did you get interested in studying Twitter seriously?
Sure. So my background is in social science. I study how people communicate with one another. And one of the limitations historically in this field is that we didn't have the data to understand complex patterns. So we could study, for example, mass media pretty reasonably well. And we might be able to study pairs of people or something. Sometimes we call them dyads. So we could study, say, interpersonal communication, how people communicate in romantic couples or between friends. But of course, we know that the real social world is very complex, and it kind of consists of all these embedded groups. So you have friends that are embedded into schools, which are embedded into communities, and so on and so forth. And we just couldn't collect data to study that. And of course, online, we have all those data at our disposal. So it's a really exciting time to be a social scientist, because suddenly all these complex patterns that we intuitively know exist in the world, we finally have data to study them. And of course, Twitter is a great example of that. That we have people communicating with their friends, we have communicating with family, we have celebrities communicating with their fans, and so on, and often simultaneously, right? So we can get these huge data sets and study how ideas spread and how messages percolate inside different communities and so on.
Okay, so before we go any further, I want to get a little bit of a primer on Twitter, because even though, you know, our president tweets and we hear so much about Twitter, my understanding is only about 1 in 5 Americans are registered users. And who knows how many of those 1 in 5 Americans have maybe registered but not used it at all. So I want to take a step back for everybody in my audience who does not use Twitter and just kind of explain how it works. Brooke, I'll start with you. This is something you can do on your phone or on your computer or your tablet. You're limited to what, 240 characters?
I think we've just raised it to 280, but okay. Yes. So it's known as a microblogging platform. Listeners might be familiar with the idea of blogs where people host personal narratives on the internet, so you can say whatever you want, whenever you want. And Twitter was formed. It's an application that you might download onto your computer or to your phone for people to post very short narratives, right? Very short, 280 characters is maybe a sentence or two at the most. And people post it, and anybody can see it. The default setting is that anyone sees what you tweet, although you can make that private. Most people don't. And then people can do what's called retweeting. So you can find someone's tweet and then pick it up and tweet it yourself. So this is a way, kind of tacit endorsement. So you say, I want people who pay attention to me to also see this message, kind of passing a note from one community to another. And there are lots of other built-in functionalities. So you can create lists of people that you're interested in seeing their tweets. You can follow certain people. And then when you log in, you'll see what they're saying. And there are many other things that people do. But I think that's sort of the nuts and bolts. So people write short messages, they read short messages, and sometimes they'll choose to retweet a short message.
And Brooke, how it's used has sort of morphed in the 12 or so years it's been around, right? I mean, in the early days, it was people just kind of maybe writing something a little entertaining to try to make someone laugh out loud or chuckle. And, and we're seeing it change. I mean, that's still part of it, right?
I think that's right. So just like we've seen other social media platforms change and evolve over time, I think Twitter started out much more on the personal narrative. So there was, you know, this sort of longstanding joke that it's folks posting what they ate for breakfast and so on. And then over time, folks realized that it was a sort of viable way to communicate breaking news. So say you are in the moment experiencing something that you want the rest of the world to know about, say a street protest or maybe an environmental catastrophe. You can also send a message out about that. And then over time, Twitter as a platform also added more functionality. So it used to be only text, and then it was text and pictures, and now it's text and video. So the richness of the communication has grown over time. So we can tell, even though we have very few characters to tell our stories, we can actually tell pretty rich stories in a short amount of space because we have these images and videos to go with it.
Judith, explain to me the hashtag. What is the purpose of a hashtag?
So a hashtag really serves two purposes. On the one hand, you use it to add meaning to your message. So, for instance, if you want to be sarcastic or funny, you can explain that by using the hashtag. Sometimes you can use a hashtag my students use often, subtweet, meaning you're saying one thing, but you're really meaning something else. So you use it to say, hey, I'm talking about hashtag vacation, hashtag fun time, hashtag, you know, Atlanta life, for instance. At the same time, when people use hashtags, that means that other people can search for these hashtags and find all the tweets that use those specific hashtags. So what you get is you get these groups of tweets that all use the same hashtags with people talking about the same topic. And it kind of creates this temporary community. So think about a very famous hashtag recently is Me Too, right? Hashtag Me Too. Came back in 2017 when Alyssa Milano, I believe, tweeted it for the first time after a number of years. Series of Twitter users jumped in on that. Other people saw it, and we got this community of women sharing their stories of sexual harassment using the hashtag MeToo. So this use of the hashtag allows people to find others like them on Twitter, communicate with them, create a collective identity, and create like a temporary community online, if you will.
Okay. And there's a new something, right? The at symbol, or relatively new in the Twitter world?
Right. So what's really interesting about Twitter is that you can, it's as Brooke said, it's a very public platform. So anything that anybody says, really anyone can see. The at symbol allows you to communicate with a specific individual. So let's say that I want to tweet to Brooke. I can do @ and then Brooke's Twitter handle. And then everybody on Twitter would see it, but Brooke would get a little notification that I've tagged her, and she and I can have a conversation. It would still be public, but it would be a way for me to draw her attention. And what you see, talking about politics, what you see a lot is that people will actually use the @ symbol for the president or for other figures in government to try to get their attention and to try to start a conversation with them.
All right. I want to return to something, Judith, you said when you were explaining retweeting and how it's sort of endorsing something, because this is a debate and discussion we've had here at this program. We have a Twitter handle @ Maine Calling. And our policy was for a while, just if anybody mentioned Maine Calling @ # Maine Calling, we would automatically retweet it. But what happens if there's some political content, something controversial in that retweet? By retweeting it, are we somehow endorsing that comment? But by not retweeting it and picking and choosing which things that we retweet, are we doing something else that may have consequences we don't want?
So, I mean, that is really a very interesting question. And what you see a lot with people who have official Twitter accounts like you all do, or people like myself who have my employer in my profile, you might see a little statement that says retweet does not equal endorsement. Just to be sure that people know that, hey, just because I'm retweeting this doesn't mean I agree. I'm retweeting this for informative purposes, because there is, like Brooke said, that natural assumption that when you retweet something, you disagree, you agree with it. Now, and it is possible, because there's two forms of retweeting. You can straight up retweet something, or you can do something called quote retweet, where you retweet what someone else said, but you add your own comments. So sometimes I'll retweet something, but I'll add a comment that makes it very clear what my opinion on that retweet is.
Brooke, how come sometimes things stick and grow and become movements on Twitter? And how come sometimes they don't?
Yeah, so this is the multi-million dollar question. So why do some things trend and some things not trend? You know, all the science that we have on this, we can't predict ahead of time what's going to trend and what's not going to trend. We can certainly see after something starts to trend, we can see the moment at which it took off. It does seem to have something to do with passing messages from folks who don't have as many followers towards folks who have more followers. But that's not the whole story, right? So sometimes things trend without ever passing through these more higher profile accounts. So one of the ways that I've developed to start to think about this, because I do think it's an important question and I understand why people want to know, is rather than thinking about, you know, is this hashtag going to trend and not that one, is to think about kind of the whole system as having a capacity to talk about certain topics. So in order for something to trend, we have to have enough people who understand what the hashtag means and who also have the vocabulary to engage with that topic. So I think it's no coincidence that Me Too trended 10 years after we started having the Me Too conversation, right? And many, many people were starting to understand not only that these experiences exist that the women were talking about, but that they are common and that they're important and that we need to address them. And after time, you know, it looks like this happened all of a sudden, but actually what was happening is the system was building up to a place where enough people paid enough attention and had enough vocabulary in order to start talking in earnest about this. So if we think about it that way, it becomes much more, you know, it's not the individual case that we're worried about, but rather whether or not the system has the tools in order to be able to talk about this sort of at a large scale.
Okay, so let's ask the other big question. I think there are a lot of big questions here, but another big question is Twitter good or bad? Judith, and you know, you talk about how this was very empowering for your young students to be able to have their voice heard and shared on something as small as a TV show or on a much larger issue. Yet on the other hand, we know that Twitter is a source of you know, I'm looking at a statistic in front of me. In 2017, 74% of Twitter users say they got news from Twitter, and a lot of that news has not been checked out. A lot of it is not accurate. So there's a lot of worry about Twitter, you know, really destroying our democracy. What are your thoughts?
So I've heard that argument you know, it's a debate that's ongoing in academics, as I'm sure Brooke can confirm. That, you know, there's the techno-optimists who get really excited about the potential of Twitter, and there's the pessimists who, you know, oh my gosh, this is the end of the world as we know it. I think at the end of the day, we need to look at the people who use the platform. The platform just gives us these tools. It's the people who use it who determine what's going to happen to our democracy. You know what I'm saying? So to say Twitter is going to ruin democracy, I think I don't necessarily agree with that. Even when you look at, you know, its potential for spreading news that may not have been checked out, I think that is outweighed by the potential of the platform to make voices that have been silenced in the past, have those voices be heard. Look at a movement like Black Lives Matter. Look at Me Too. Look at all the attention that cases like Eric Garner received, the George Zimmerman case. A lot of that is in part due to Twitter. To me, the value that comes out of magnifying marginalized voices outweighs risks like fake news or others that come with using such a platform.
All right. And do you agree, Brooke?
I absolutely agree. So in some ways, there's a kind of value judgment here, right? So obviously, I think it's important to start centering previously marginalized voices. So I place a lot of value on that. But then even beyond, if we are to think of through kind of implications of what it means to be having conversations about fake news, of course, people being misinformed is a problem, but I actually think there's a little silver lining here. If you'll let me indulge for a minute, I think, you know, when we're talking about fake news, you know, misinformation has existed in the public for a long time, but suddenly we're taking that issue seriously. So the educator in me says, well, look, we have an opportunity here to talk about media literacy, right? And that is a, you know, it's a problem on Twitter, but it's also an opportunity that people are becoming more aware of. I mean, we're talking in earnest now about introducing media literacy programs into K-12 education, which I think is pretty fantastic and is, you know, the end result may be a more informed public, right? So a public that is able to discern sort of truthful from less truthful news information or things that were generated by authentic news organizations versus things that were generated, you know, not meant to be authentic news.
All right. Well, on the line with us now, Craig Freshley, facilitator who a few years ago started organizing something he calls the makeshift coffee houses. Craig's goal was and is to get people with different political viewpoints talking to and with instead of at each other. Craig, welcome back to Maine Calling. And I want to ask you, has the use of Twitter come up at your coffee house?
Oh, thanks for having me part of the conversation, Jennifer. It has, and often it goes something like this. My gosh, I'm glad we're not having this conversation in Twitter or on Facebook or by email. Unfortunately, Twitter gets a little bit of a bad rap in a makeshift coffee house environment where people have deliberately come out into the cold to a public place to talk to each other face-to-face.
What do you believe the disadvantages of Twitter and social media are compared to face-to-face?
Well, first of all, let me acknowledge the advantages. I love what I've heard so far. I can totally see that Twitter gives people a voice who are otherwise not able to be heard. I love the movements that have been created, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, etc. Awesome. The disadvantages are that it's very easy to, one, say mean things with no face-to-face or immediate repercussion, two, say false things, and three, not have the immediate feedback of how your message is being received. There's a lot that can be easily misunderstood when you only have 240 characters. Those are the disadvantages.
All right. Well, you have a coffee house coming up, don't you?
Oh, that's right. People are going to get together face-to-face and talk about politics tonight at the Belfast Middle School. It starts at 6 o'clock. If you want to have a face-to-face conversation about politics, come along, or you can learn about future events at our website, makeshiftcoffeehouse.com.
All right. Well, Craig, thanks for calling into today's program. Craig Freshley, a facilitator and creator of Makeshift Coffee Houses. We do have to take a break. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. 399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air...
I realize that this marriage has turned out to be something quite different to what we both imagined.
Understatement.
On the Netflix series The Crown, a young Queen Elizabeth and her husband Philip adjust to a new life, lived in the public eye yet bound by the constraints and traditions of the British monarchy. We'll speak with series creator Peter Morgan. He also wrote The Queen and Frost Nixon. Join us.
Join us tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. We have another Maine Calling on the Road live event coming up. Tomorrow, Jen Rooks and the Maine Calling team will be live at 1 o'clock in Lewiston at Bates College's Muskie Archives, and you're invited. The topic is Purposeful Work, and Bates College initiative that aligns student interests and talents with the skills and work they will pursue after graduation, and fosters connections between Maine companies and potential employees. The event is free, but space is limited, so if you'd like to join us, please register by going to mainepublic.org and click on events. Thank you. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, why and how Twitter has become such a prominent source of political and social movement communication. With me in the studio, Judith Rosenbaum Andre, an assistant professor at UMaine's Department of Communication and Journalism. And on the line with us, Brooke Foucault-Wells. She is an assistant professor of communications at Northeastern University. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Judith, you really like what Brooke had to say about media literacy and having this conversation about Twitter lead into something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really funny that you know, media literacy is back in the spotlight. My dissertation was on media literacy back in the early 2000s, and there wasn't that much attention to it back then. People kind of assumed that what the news said was true and correct, and why do we need media literacy? And so, like Brooke, I am very excited that now suddenly we have all this attention directed towards, hey, we maybe need to educate our citizens on recognizing when is news credible, when is news reliable, and when is it not. So I see that as just this great educational moment.
It's interesting. Earlier this month, Brooke, we had a moment where there were groups asking Twitter to stop publishing, if that's the right word, President Trump's tweets. Was that an interesting moment for you? And what did you think of how the request was made and what the response was from Twitter CEO?
I mean, look, so I started talking about political communication on Twitter in 2014. And I would have to start all of my talks with sort of explaining why we ought to care about what's on Twitter. And that's totally gone out the window, right? So it's self-evident now. When the president sort of uses a Twitter-first strategy, it is self-evident that Twitter is an important part of our political communication tools. You know, now, whether or not certain people ought to be silenced on Twitter, I'm not sure I'm ready to weigh in on that. I think, you know, there is certainly, I understand where the folks who are asking for the president's tweets to be silenced, folks feel as if some of the things he's saying are dangerous and putting people at risk. On the other hand, you know, there's some interesting things going on when we talk about silencing and removing voices from Twitter. We might have the unintended side effect of removing voices that ought to actually be heard. So I'm not sure that is for us as academics to decide whose voices get heard and whose voices don't get heard. I am really interested in the conversations folks are having, trying to debate the terms of what voices are important to hear and what voices are not. And I think that it's super interesting that even the President of the United States gets included in that debate.
All right, we're going to go to Steve, who's calling from Bucksport. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to comment on a rather disturbing trend I've seen, the so-called bots, which are these anonymous or very calculated automated respondents who can squelch a topic. So perhaps maybe I'll say something on global warming and suddenly I'll be inundated with these brand new members of Facebook who have 2,000 friends and are countering what I say with obnoxious or false misinformation. I was wondering if the experts could comment on this trend.
Brooke, have you followed that? The proliferation of these bots that are not real people, but are mm-hmm. what are they exactly? And what are they doing to people's social media feeds?
Sure. I mean, it's an interesting challenge for us to all think about. So there are different layers. There's the kind of dumb bots or lazy bots, right? So these are just very simple algorithms that look for keywords and then will retweet things or add, tweet back at people when they say certain keywords. So those are pretty easy to filter out, honestly. There's also a new kind of sort of smart social bot. So here we look at the patterns of Twitter use that folks are, real humans are engaging in, and then the algorithms try to replicate those patterns. They're much harder to filter out. In some ways, they look an awful lot like real people. And then there's a kind of third category where it's actual real humans. Sometimes we call these trolls. So these are actual real humans who are either paid or who volunteer to tweet about certain topics. But they're doing so along a certain kind of script, right? So they're not communicating quite as authentically as we might argue an actual human with an actual opinion on the topic or a sort of independent opinion on the topic might be tweeting about. So it's hard for me. So I think that filtering out the dumb bots makes a lot of sense. It's hard for me to say that we ought to filter out all bots. I agree with the caller that in some cases they're dangerous and they can be used to kind of plaster over authentic conversations that are happening on Twitter. But then in other cases, I look at online activism networks and we do see bots that are used to sort of amplify voices that might otherwise not get heard. So I do think like all the things that we've been talking about today, the communication patterns are a little bit complicated. And this is an area that's sort of ripe for future research to understand, how can a non-human or a partially human agent be engaging in a conversation in a way that's productive and not so productive, and where do we draw boundaries on what we want included and excluded?
Steve, thanks for your call. We have a tweet, very appropriate for today. This is from Marfine. How do we balance free speech, real news, and protection from hate speech? We're not shying away from the big questions today. Judith, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. So I think that, and this also ties into what Steve said, is there's this real desire for interaction on Twitter. People take to Twitter because they want to speak to real people in a way that's civil and respectful, right? And that's what the people in Greg's coffee houses are saying, too. But at the same time, they want to have, they want to be free and safe from bots and all this negative comments. And I think that's where Twitter shows the potential because, yes, there are bots. And yes, there are people who say, as Greg said, horrible things without repercussions. But there's also every once in a while you get very good conversations between people on opposite ends of the spectrum. And I've seen this in my research where people who are completely in disagreement with each other will work through a topic through numerous tweets and end up not coming to an agreement, but coming to mutual respect, if you will. And I think that Twitter allows people who would have otherwise never been in contact with each other to find each other and communicate. And I do think it's important to maybe step away from this idealized version that we have of democracy. So we were all raised on this notion of this Habermasian ideal. We all get into this room together and we have this very mellow, laid back, respectful conversation. Twitter isn't like that. People are rude. People are mean. People say scary things. I don't think that necessarily detracts from democracy. And there's been several scholars, Chantal Mouffe is one of them, who have said, when people get very passionate and very angry, that is a form of democratic exchange too. And we just need to acknowledge that. So we need to encourage freedom of speech, even if it's not nice and even if it doesn't make us feel warm and fuzzy. I think it can still help build democracy.
Brooke, are there certain groups of people that use Twitter more than other groups, whether by age, ethnicity, profession?
Yeah, demographically, we see a higher percentage of people of color on Twitter than on other social media platforms relative to white folks. The Twitter user population tends to skew young, so we have a higher proportion of the users are in the 18 to 40 demographic than any other. And it also tends to skew urban, so folks who live closer to big cities tend to more often use Twitter than folks who do not. So we do get a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a bias, but a kind of filtering on some of those, the topics that might be of interest to folks who meet those demographic criteria.
Judith, this is an election year. Not the presidential election, but just about everything else. What are we going to see that maybe we have either haven't before or we're going to see in new and different ways on Twitter and other social media platforms?
I think that we're definitely going to see candidates who are much more active on social media than they've ever been before. So I believe Barack Obama was the first presidential candidate to actively use Facebook back in 2008. And then, of course, with this past presidential election, Twitter really exploded with the I'm with her hashtag and the MAGA hashtag. And I think we're going to see even local elections possibly developing their own hashtags. If we look here in Maine, Susan Collins has a very good Twitter presence. And I think we're going to see that extend to other candidates as well. Because even though people may not like Twitter, what is said on Twitter does influence the news cycle. It does influence what we hear on television and radio. And I think political candidates are realizing that more and more, and they're going to jump on that bandwagon.
What do you think, Brooke?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Judith. And I think in it, because folks will take to Twitter and folks will use Twitter sort of in earnest to talk about their platform, we also might get a slightly different flavor on what we know about candidates, right? So the interesting thing about Twitter is you can kind of simultaneously have this professional presence or this political presence, but we also get leaks about who you are as a person. So we saw this with Hillary Clinton's Twitter during the election. So we saw mostly sort of professional or crafted messages, but then we see these little glimpses of maybe her with her grandkids, right? In ways that, you have to optimize your mainstream media coverage, right? So you might not buy an ad that shows who you are, who your personality is, or shows these kinds of other sides to your personality. So I do like that. Just like we see celebrities have these like nuanced presences on Twitter, I think we will also see politicians kind of come into that as they get more and more sophisticated with the platform.
But I also think that social media will force politicians to possibly be more cautious in how they address certain audiences. So when Brooke brought up Hillary Clinton's Twitter presence, one of the things that happened during her campaign is she created an ad with a tagline, "Not Mi Abuela." And so all these Latinx Twitter users took to Twitter to make it very clear that, no, Hillary Clinton was not their abuela. And so I think that with social media responding to what candidates do in public, that they're going to have to be more careful in how they address specific audiences, because they can no longer separate how they market to this demographic from how they market to that demographic, as they all collapse into one audience online.
Mm. We have an email from Owen. Is there a place for government intervention regarding social media platforms?
I can speak to this a little bit. So I do think we are getting to the point where we need some kind of regulation, and particularly thinking across platforms is where the government might get involved, or perhaps the government might encourage the industry to create consortia where they have agreed upon strategies. So the truth is that on any given platform, there are reporting infrastructures for, say, real threats or real harassment, right? So if folks are feeling not just uncomfortable, but actually at risk, you can report that. But if folks are going to engage in sort of targeted harassment campaigns, it's almost never limited to just Twitter or to just Facebook or to just Reddit or any of the other single platforms. It happens across all of those platforms. And that can be very difficult to deal with, because as you report to one, then folks will migrate to the next, and then you sort of take care of the next one, and they go back to the first one, and so on and so forth. So I do think there's a place where we ought to be starting to have these conversations about how are we going to handle sort of targeted harassment across multiple platforms and who's going to be in charge of that. And so far, the industry seems pretty reluctant to kind of collaborate in order to create these kinds of tools. So this might be a place where the government gets involved, or it might be a place where the public sort of applies enough pressure that the industry takes it on it themselves. But I do think that we need some innovation there.
Yeah, I agree that really where we want to see government regulation is when it comes to these targeted harassment campaigns. Anything beyond that makes me a little bit uncomfortable, because then we get into what Brooke was talking about earlier. You know, how do you determine who is allowed to speak and who is not? And that's where I think we might start hurting the democratic potential of these social media platforms.
All right. Well, we're talking about Twitter and politics and social movements. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can post to our Facebook page. And, of course, you can tweet at Maine Calling. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We will be broadcasting live from Bates College, and we're going to be talking about the concept of purposeful work. If you'd like to send us an email or a Facebook post ahead of time, please do so. And if you're interested in coming to watch the show, visit our website for more information about attending tomorrow's program. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. An Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
At a county jail in Texas, a 27-year-old man is preparing for 7 years in prison. He says he wants to do his time, change his life, and not look back.
I know that gangster life or whatever, that's not me. Like, I don't care about being the hardest dude or none of that stuff.
I want to tell you something, man. Everybody is nervous. Nobody wants to be in prison, despite what they might show.
Advice from a former inmate to a new one. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up shortly, it's the Commonwealth Club of California. Matt Walker, professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley, provides a new understanding of sleep and how it affects our ability to learn, memorize, and make logical decisions. Coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Twitter and Modern Politics. In the studio with me, Judith Rosenbaum Andre, an assistant professor at UMaine's Department of Communication and Journalism. She is the author of the new book, Constructing Digital Cultures: Tweets, Trends, Race, and Gender. And on the line with us, Brooke Foucault-Wells. She's assistant professor of communications at Northeastern University. She studies how social networks shape and constrain human behavior. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to continue something we were just talking about off mic during the break. And Judith, Twitter has some strengths and some weaknesses. What is it really good for?
I think Twitter is good for several things. And one of the main things, as Brooke mentioned, is breaking news. So during the break, we were talking about when I lived in Georgia, we had a tornado come right through our county. And I actually found out through Twitter. The sirens went off, but the tornado happened to come through Saturday at noon when they test our sirens. So,
oh my gosh,
I went on Twitter and I realized there is a tornado warning. And that's what propelled us down into the laundry room. I also think that Twitter's one of its major strengths is to connect groups of people that are usually not heard in mainstream media and gives them strength in numbers. So a movement like the civil rights movement took several years, you know, to gain traction, to make it into the mainstream media. Black Lives Matter was started in 2013, and in 2014, everybody'd heard about it. And that's because of Twitter's potential. And I think that's something we cannot underestimate.
You know, when I read your introduction, Brooke, I say that you study how social networks shape and constrain human behavior. Have Twitter and other social networks changed us, changed the human race? Do we think differently now? Do we act differently now?
I'm not sure it's changed the human race or changed our brains. I wouldn't go that far. But, you know, one of the other assets of Twitter that I would add to Judith's list is that it has created new pathways for connections, right? So we didn't have, we've long had a mainstream media out to the public pathway, but we didn't really have strong pathways in the other direction before. So when we talk about shaping and constraining human behavior, the idea that you, a regular person, person can tweet out to a celebrity or to a journalist or even to a politician and get a response very quickly is somewhat novel and somewhat new. So, and Twitter and similar platforms like it have really enabled that kind of two-way conversation to happen.
And I completely agree with that. And one of the things I hear up in Maine a lot is, well, not everybody's on Twitter. Why is this platform even relevant? Well, what, like Brooke said, Twitter has given ordinary people the ability to influence the media agenda. You know, prior to Twitter, it was really the media kind of determined what the public thought about. Now the public has an opportunity to influence the mainstream media. And not everybody who's listening right now might be on Twitter. But they should realize that in spite of that, what is said on Twitter will influence the media, which will then influence public consciousness.
We'll go to Mike calling from Orland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. So I've been following a Twitter handle, Tiffany Bond for CD2. This is an independent woman who's running for the 2nd Congressional District. And she wouldn't even, I think, have been on my radar were it not for the fact that she and I are both on Twitter. I used to think that you'd have to be part of a major political party to sort of get traction. But I no longer think so. I think a social media savvy person like Tiffany is can really go from 0 to 60 using Twitter as a platform.
And I think that's definitely very true. And I think that Twitter has, in that respect, leveled the playing field. Although we do have to keep in mind, like Brooke said earlier, that you know, people who are on Twitter are more likely to be urban, younger, African-American. And so that may not apply to, say, the rural counties in northern Maine, per se, but it definitely applies in the more urban areas like here in Portland.
How soon do you think, actually, I should rephrase that, will that change? Will Twitter soon be something everyone uses? And if so, how soon? I read that Twitter's actually has fewer users now than it did in 2016.
Right. And I do believe that I've read the same thing, that the Twitter user number has dwindled. Honestly, I find that a very, very difficult topic to speak on because younger people are moving to different platforms. You know, so there will always be a Twitter, but whether it will be Twitter or Snapchat or the platform that hasn't been invented yet, I don't know.
Yeah, and also, you know, picking up on something Judith said before, don't forget that even if you don't use Twitter, you are hearing about tweets. So whether you're doing so directly because the news covers the president's tweets or whether you do so indirectly because your local journalists are looking on Twitter for trending topics. So the number of people who are actually on Twitter, of course, those people are going to be more heavily influenced by things they see on Twitter. But that number may, in fact, be quite a bit bigger if we include all the folks whose ideas or opinions are influenced by things that either started on Twitter, were hashed out and negotiated on Twitter, or continue to percolate on Twitter.
We'll go to Skip calling from Stonington. Hi, Skip. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Good. And you?
Good. Your program is wonderful. I listen to it every day, and I learn so much. And as it occurred to me during this discussion, I'd like to ask you guests, to what extent did Russia get involved in the election by using Twitter? And is there something that Congress should think about enacting to prohibit that from taking place again?
Brooke, what do we know about Russia and Twitter? Or do we know?
I mean, I think the answer is we don't know exactly what happened. You know, there's any number of investigations, both academic and, you know, in the government going on right now to figure out exactly what all happened. We do have evidence now, though, that there were Russian-originated accounts that were doing things like retweeting potentially controversial hashtags. So it's really interesting to think about what it would mean for a foreign government to leverage contentious or complicated political conversations that are happening inside the U.S. and use that to maybe their advantage or to sow discontent inside the U.S. And I do think that this speaks to, you know, some of the issues we've talked about getting people together to have conversations either face-to-face or even on Twitter to have conversations where they maybe reconcile different opinions. And it also speaks to, you know, the need to continue to be vigilant about our media literacy, right? So there are ways that we can detect, you know, some of these bots or or non-human agents that might be on Twitter. And there are also ways that we can reconcile, you know, what seems maybe too extreme to actually be real. So can we teach people some tools in order to make better judgments about whether or not they want to engage with a particular account that they're seeing on Twitter?
So, Brooke, I actually have a question for you, just scholar to scholar here. Okay. Is when people bring up, you know, there were Russian agents on Twitter who were actively putting stuff out there, how is that different from, say, a Russia-backed organization taking out a page ad in the New York Times, for instance? Were we ever worried about that? Should we be? How do you see that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great question, right? So foreign governments often interfere inside the political conversations,
right,
inside a particular government, either through dropping leaflets, right, taking out ads. You know, I do think that maybe because this was so new, it wasn't quite on people's radar. So we all have our ways of being suspicious or being skeptical about media claims. You know, we're well conditioned, for example, to look at ads, you know, with some amount of skepticism. Maybe we weren't so conditioned to do that with tweets or particular Twitter accounts. So maybe we need to learn how to do that so that we can apply a kind of skeptical eye to what we're reading. You know, but folks are developing great tools. So Emilio Ferreira is doing all this great work on detecting bots and creating tools for lay people to go in and detect, you know, you can type in a Twitter handle and see if the account you're following is a bot or not. So I think that those tools are coming. And as we get more and more conversant in what's possible on Twitter, we can also get, you know, healthier and healthier in the way that we view the information that's there.
Skip, good question. Thanks for asking. We have an email from Jim. Would you describe what it takes and how it works for Twitter, the company, to decide that someone has crossed the line and will be temporarily or permanently suspended? Do we know? Go ahead, Judith.
Well, obviously, that's a very, very good question, because several people have called on, as you said earlier, on Twitter to suspend Donald Trump's account because he's calling for aggression towards certain groups of people or towards certain nations, and Twitter didn't take any action. So I don't think a company such as Twitter is prepared for what is being said and done on the platform right now. And I think what we're seeing is a clear sign, as we were saying earlier, that these corporations need to rethink how they regulate speech on their platforms.
We'll go to Jean calling for... Oh, go ahead. Jean, you hold on, and Brooke, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say there are certain things that are sort of known violations that would cause your account to get suspended or even permanently eliminated. So things like direct threats, things like impersonating other people. So there are some things. I think the challenge is that, you know, what is exactly a direct threat, right? So one person's perceived direct threat was not intended to be that way. So, you know, just building on what Judith said, it can be complicated for these platforms, and I don't think that they have the tools in place. They don't have the departments to review these things. They haven't really thought about what would happen under certain circumstances. So hopefully that's all developing. And this may be one of those places where the public applies pressure to say, look, we need better tools and resources for this, because there are conditions that we know are existing that are making people unsafe, or at least to feel unsafe on these platforms.
Jean in Portland, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been a victim of a Facebook posting that was untrue and malicious, and suddenly there sprang up all these, I'll say, to rate the doctor, because you can rate several professions. I'm not a doctor, but for the point. Rate the doctor pages that suddenly sprang up around the date that this thing got 5 million views. It's damaged my professional reputation greatly, and I'm really trying hard to take down these pages, take down these nasty things that total strangers have written.
Wow. Jean, now you're talking about Facebook. Let me just ask you.
And Google.
And Google. Brooke, do you have any thoughts for Jean about how to control this?
I mean, Jean, first of all, I'm really sorry that happened to you. I mean, we know it does happen from time to time that folks just become targeted by what seems like this never-ending mob of people, you know, engaging in these targeted harassment campaigns. You know, there are some resources out there, so I don't know if you know about the Crash Override Network. So it is an advocacy group started by one of the targets of the Gamergate campaign, which was you know, folks attacking women in the gaming industry, but they have some resources that can help people either manage their own accounts or they even will get involved in some cases to help you out with that. So I would certainly suggest looking at that just as a pragmatic thing. You know, and then this is one of those places where I do think we need either government or industry, you know, to step up and to create stronger regulations, because it does happen from time to time. And the harm is real. So there is emotional and psychological distress. There's often real financial consequences for people and their careers. And there's, of course, the reputational challenges, right? So it can be very hard to remove all of this false information from the internet. You know, Europe is a little bit ahead of the U.S. On some of these regulations, and it maybe is time for us to think about those in earnest, to how we're going to help people like Jean.
And Jean, for me too, I mean, that sounds absolutely horrible. And I think one of the things you could do proactively is create a very active online presence. So create a Twitter account, create maybe your own website where you counter these claims so that when people search for you, they find both the negative and the positive, and they realize that the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Jean, thanks so much for your call, and good luck to you. We'll try to squeeze in one more. We'll go to Susan in Naples. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. If you could be quick, that would be great.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, great. Yeah, hi. Thank you so much. My question is really just about Twitter. In general, there's a way that you can get impressions. Like, you can press this analytics button or whatever and get impressions. And people can get, like, literally thousands of impressions on something that they tweet, and yet they don't necessarily get retweeted or liked or commented about. And I'm wondering if your guests have any thoughts on that, because I get that a lot, and it's very weird. You know, like, evidently something I'm saying is impactful on some level, but yet certain people are not moved to retweet or comment
okay.
about
okay.
it.
Okay, so you're talking about some of the analytics. Judith, you've got less than a minute to explain this.
So on Twitter, and I know what you mean, because sometimes you get these huge numbers and you're like, where do they come from? And sometimes it could be that your friends like it and that your friends have thousands of followers who now see that they have liked your tweet. And that in itself could impact your analytics. So it doesn't necessarily take a retweet. The way Twitter is set up now is that when someone else clicks on the heart by your tweet, their followers will see that they did that. And so now you're not only exposed to your followers, but to your followers' followers as well. So that means your tweet has a much higher rate of visibility.
Okay, Susan, you're our last question of the hour. We're out of time. I really want to thank both of you. Judith Rosenbaum Andre, assistant professor at UMaine's Department of Communication and Journalism, the author of Constructing Digital Cultures, Tweets, Trends, Race, and Gender. And Brooke Foucault-Wells is an assistant professor of communications at Northeastern University. She joined us from Boston. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from Roddy Nickpour. Owen Manahan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we will be broadcasting live from Bates College, and our topic, Finding Purposeful Work. You are invited to join us for this live broadcast. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.